Members, 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the March 24th, 2021 meeting of the Taxes Committee to order under Rules 10.01. And with that, Ms. Griska, would you please call the roll?
Marquardt.
Present.
Marquardt, present. Lislegard.
Present.
Lislegard, present. Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Abaje.
Present.
Abaje, present. Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Carlson, present. Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Detmer, present. Garofalo.
Garofalo, present.
Garofalo, present. Gomez.
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Her.
Her, present.
Her, present. Hertas.
Hertas, present.
Hertas, present. Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. McDonald.
Old McDonald, present.
McDonald, present. Miller.
Miller, present.
Miller, present. Moran.
Present.
Moran, present. Mortensen.
Present.
Mortensen, present. Robbins.
Present.
Robbins, present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Schultz.
Present.
Schultz, present. Stevenson.
Present.
Stevenson, present. Swazinski.
Present.
Swazinski, present. Joachim.
Present.
Joachim, present. We have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Griska. We do have a quorum. We're going to move to approval of the minutes. Representative Lislegard, have you thoroughly reviewed those March 23rd 2021 minutes? Would you care to make a motion to approve?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lislegard moves approval of the March 23rd, 2021 minutes. Any discussion or comments on those? If not, members, I'm going to ask you to temporarily unmute yourselves as we take the vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Say nay. The motion does prevail. The March 23rd, 2021 minutes of the Taxes Committee are approved. Members, a little bit of changes on schedules that have come out, although I think the latest one was the correct one as we've made some changes. But we're going to hear four bills as the intent this afternoon. And we're going to start with Representative Franson's bill, and then we're going to do the beginning farmer credit bill, and then the two that were originally up. The bill on the global intangible low tax income and the worldwide combined reporting. And then we're going to recess and then come back tonight at 6 o'clock to do two other bills, which is Representative Hansen on de-transfer mortgage tasks for soil and water conservation districts, and Representative Lislegard's bill on the film tax credit. And so with that, we're going to start with House File 2293, Representative Franson's bill. Do I hear a motion to for that bill?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Swazinski?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to move that Franson bill forward before the committee. Also, will we be voting on any bills today, moving them out, or are we just hearing for possible?
Very good. So before I take that motion, great question. Yes, we will be voting on House File 1733, and that will be sending it back to the Authors Committee on Environment. So it'll be that one tonight, nothing this morning, or nothing this afternoon. Representative Swazinski, would you care to move House File 2293?
Mr. Chair, I move House File 2293 before the Tax Committee for possible inclusion.
All right, then be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Representative Franson, welcome to the Taxes Committee, and I know you also have a DE1 amendment. So, Representative Swazinski, would you like to move the DE1 amendment? I will move the DE1 amendment. Representative Franson, what does DE1 amendment do, or does it put it in the form you want, and then we'll go from there?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first off, thank you for this opportunity. Mr. Chair, we have been going back and forth for almost a year now on this bill. Well, actually, it's been over a year. When we were going to take this bill up last year is when we were sent home due to the COVID shutdown of the legislature. So thank you for allowing me to present this bill. So last year, last February, there was
Representative Franson, we need to move the DE1 amendment.
And so that already.
That's going to put the bill in its proper form. So yep. let's take a vote on that first. Any questions or comments before we take that vote? Seeing none, I'm going to ask for the vote on the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The DE1 amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Franson, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was saying, there was a devastating fire last February that took out a big chunk of a block in downtown Alexandria on Broadway there, of which those buildings are very historic. There was some need for removal of asbestos. There's a lot of costs associated with the downtown fire. So basically, this bill provides an exemption from the sales tax and use tax for the cleaning, replacing, remediation of the damage. And then also we're asking for an exemption to the sales and purchases made after February 20th and before February 28th, 2023. And I also have my constituents from Alexandria, one of which they owned Rapper's Bar and Grill on that block. That entire business was burnt and demolished, and there is just an empty square block with dirt there where the historic building once stood. And I have Andy and Cammie Rassett, who are still the owners of Rapper's Bar and Grill, but to speak to this bill and on behalf of the other individuals that were affected by the fire.
Very good. So we've got Cammie Rassett and Andy Rassett, and we've got a number of bills today, so I would ask testifiers to keep their testimony to 3 minutes. And so who would like to go first? Oh, they're together. All right, very good. So as you speak, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself before you speak and then begin your testimony. Thank you.
I am Cammie. My husband, Andy.
I am Andy.
First of all, we just want to say thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been a tough year, as everybody else has had too, but we just want to thank you in advance for just even considering this for us. So long story short, we'll make it fast. 26 years ago, we were just kids. We looked at downtown, and what did it need? It needed some life. It needed a sports bar. So that's what we built for the last 24 years. That has been our home. That has been our spot in Alec. As far as being part of the community. A year ago, that fateful day, we had a huge fire that broke out and took 4 buildings in downtown, 2 of them which we owned and 2 of them that were owned by 2 other business owners. I guess we must have drew the short straw today, and we're here talking for everybody. So what we're asking for is a little help in the costs that exceeded our insurance that just didn't cover it. With the old buildings, we didn't realize the amount of asbestos, lead that were in those buildings. So we have a big gap. And that big gap has been really hard in moving forward to rebuild, to fill that void downtown and be a part of our community again. So that is basically what we're asking for. There was a lot of asbestos, the lead, the chemical that was used to put the fire out. So I guess that is the hidden expenses is what we're really looking for your help to offset those so that we can go forward and be a part of our vital downtown again. And that's what the other business owners are looking for too.
So
just, you know, Andy, because of the cost of, you know, probably like 30%. We're just looking to offset that, to rebuild, hopefully rebuild in the future and fill the whole downtown of block five. It's half of a block was destroyed. And I know Alexandria is missing it, and a lot of people visit this area, and they want us to fill it. And they've been asking us for over a year what we're going to do, and now we could possibly move on.
Well, thank you, Andy and Cammie, for representing the business district in those damage. You've done very well, and hopefully the committee can be of some help, as little as it can be. Granted, what you've gone through, hopefully we can provide some assistance. Representative Joaquin.
I just want to thank the testifiers for being here today, and I'm so sorry about the loss of your business that took you so many years to build. It must be like losing your home away from home. I hope that we can include this in the tax bill, because in Minnesota, when disaster strikes and it's out of your control, we help rebuild, and that's what we should be doing all over the state. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Cammie and Tammy. Kind of like the Beatles. What we'll get. Just curious on the old historic building you have. Are you able to rebuild to similar specs and have that same old charm of those old 100-year-old buildings?
With the current money.
Andy Rassett?
We'd love to. You know, most of them are all made out of brick. So we don't know what, you know, the future will hold for that. Honestly, it's with construction costs right now. It's our two buildings, yeah, were built back in the 1800s, and it's hard to redo all the brick basements. You know, it was the structure was pretty much brick and shared the adjoining foundations, which is tough to do that nowadays.
Our hope is to fill something in that is pretty congruent to what it looks like, even if it's under the new stipulations. Obviously, if to put sprinklers and elevators and added expenses, but our goal is to put something in that will look awesome downtown and not look like it didn't belong there. We want something that looks pretty original.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think you'll find that this committee is very sympathetic and understands the situation, and we are, you know, we see a lot of these bills that
Representative McDonald, you're
for the materials,
breaking up a little
kind
bit.
I had a blanket help for like found or, you know. Oh, I was just, I just said I support the bill and certainly helping our friends who lost their homes or their businesses to fires and stuff. I'm an old 100-year-old historic building, so I know how devastating that is to businesses from Alexandria to Minneapolis to Delano. So
thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mary Francis, for bringing it to our attention. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've supported bills like this in the past, and I think we can support this bill. I have a question, though. Did Ole the Viking survive?
He's good.
He's good.
He's good. He doesn't have a place to get a beer from anymore, but he's okay.
Okay.
Sounds like he's doing all right, Representative Detmer.
My wife graduated from the high school there in Alec, and we've been there a few times. So it's a beautiful city. It's growing. I know that. So
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on Zoom that would like to testify on House File 2293 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Franzen, closing comments.
I just want to thank the committee for their time, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to bug you during the interim as well on this topic. So,
thank you very much, Representative Franzen. So Representative Swazinski renews his motion to lay over House File 2293 as amended. for possible inclusion into the House tax omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Franson. Andy and Cammy, thank you for testifying today.
Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to turn the meeting over for the next two bills to Vice Chair Wesselgaard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The next bill on the agenda is 1456 from Representative Marcourt. Marcourt, would you like to move your bill?
I will move House File 1456 for possible inclusion into the omnibus tax bill, and I do have an A2 amendment if I could move that right now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Marcourt moves that the A2 author's amendment be adopted. Representative Marcourt, please explain to the committee your amendment.
Yeah, that it basically puts the bill into the form I would like, so if we could get this approved and then I could speak to the bill as amended.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, good. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Marcourt, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. House File 1456, now as amended, is an attempt to expand what has been really a very successful program, and it's the beginning farmers tax credit. And it was enacted into law in 2017 with the leadership of Chair Davids in that tax bill. And he really pushed this bill. It was nation leading. I don't know if there's any, there was another type of program like this that Chair Davids pushed. And the whole concept was to get more young people into farming. In Minnesota, the average age of a farmer is 55 years old. And in the United States, there are six times more farmers over the age of 65 than there are under the age of 35. And so the whole intent is to be able to, as these older farmers retire and get out of the business, how do we get younger ones to replace them? That is a real concern. And so this bill was set up, and a beginning farmer is someone who's been in farming 10 years or less. Their main occupation is going to be farming. They're experienced in that. And as part of the bill, they may be required to attend a financial management class. And that is also covered up to $1,500 credit for up to 3 years. So it's kind of a, you know, it not only tries to incentivize young farmers, beginning farmers, but also make sure they get off to a good financial basis. And the Rural Finance Authority is, through the MDA, is the division that kind of administers this. And so how it works is on a sale of property or land, the owner of that land would be able to get like a 5% credit up to a maximum of $32,000. And then on rent, it's either 10 or 15% up to like $7,000 or $10,000 based upon whether or not it's a shared rent agreement or not. But it's providing a tax credit to the owner. And so what has it done in the last few years since it started? $6 million has been appropriated. That's a cap. And in 2018, there's 378 beginning farmers who participate. In 2019, it was 527. And in 2020, 444. And the average expenditure has been about $2.7 million. And those dollars are carried forward. So right now in the program, there's about $12 million that's in the cap right now, or would be available. So what my amendment, what the bill does, isn't anything with increasing funding. It's trying to increase access. And one thing about the bill is there's going to be a study that is going to be due on February 1st. When this was passed in 2017, it had a sunset. There'll be a study on February 1st of 2022, and then this program would sunset after tax year 2023. And if I had my druthers, I would look at extending it, but I think we should see the report first. I mean, I think that's due diligence, and we still have 22 and 23 to extend it. So that bill is, this bill isn't doing that either. So three parts. What this would do is extend it to family members. Right now, family members are excluded. And so it would be sons, daughters, and grandchildren. And there certainly are some safeguards that would be put up just because of a family to a family situation. And that is, this only involves land or equipment sales. It does, the family addition does not apply to any of the rent situation. And a further guardrail on this is that if it's a, you know, assessed land, it would have to be sold at 100% of the assessed value or higher. And if they don't know the assessed value, it's 80% or more of the market value. But we know that in a lot of cases, the children of farmers are not coming back and farming, and it's difficult. This would help keep that also in the generational family farm. A second provision in there is that it would raise the 5% to 10% of the value of the $32,000 on the sale for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. And that would allow more people of color, emerging farmers, to become part of that. That definition is actually part of the USDA. It was put into law in 1990. So that would expand and help get more emerging farmers involved. And the last and final thing this bill does, it provides some funding, basically 5% of the allocation of $6 million, which would be $300,000, to the Rural Finance Authority. And for, not only do they implement this right now and administer, and they make sure beginning farmers qualify and help them and so forth, but right now there is no online application. No online application. Or everything has to be by paper, and this would also help establish that. So, members, that is the bill. And again, I thank Chair Davids for being a leader on this program, that we're actually seeing some pretty good success. I would be open for questions.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a couple testifiers. The first one is Mr. Clover. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Leslie Gard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Clover. I know it comes up with James. I go by my middle name. I'm here to testify in support of Chair Marquardt's bill to expand the beginning farmer tax credit. I farm currently with my family just outside of Northfield, and this tax credit over the last couple of years has been a big help to me as I've gotten established on the farm. Been farming coming up on 4 years now on my own outside of what my parents do, and the majority of that time I spend raising hogs. I've been able to utilize that beginning farmer tax credit over the last couple of years on the pigs that I'm purchasing to bring into my barn. I got kind of partnered up with a neighboring family farm just outside of Nearstrand, and then I buy a group of feeder pigs every 16 weeks, raise them up to market. But that tax credit, by them selling the livestock to me, we've been able to capitalize on the tax credit. They get the advantage on that side. But really, it's helped me as a beginning farmer. I don't have a whole lot of equity. It's tough to get started. So last year was challenging. So going through all of those challenges with the lows on the hog prices and everything, because of that tax credit, we've been able to kind of facilitate that relationship, and there was some give and take on the prices. So they were able to give me a little bit more of a break on the pigs that I purchased. So that way I could continue farming. So it's been a huge boon on that side. Expanding it further to cover the sale of agricultural assets to kids and grandkids makes sense with the idea of generational farm transition. That transition piece has been a very hot topic in my family of late. My father is approaching 65, getting closer to wanting to retire, and looking at how to transfer that land and everything into the next generation and get my brother and I started, it's a challenge. So by having that tax incentive to be able to to sell some of that land to my brother and I, it would allow us to get our foot in the door more on the family operation as well. Increasing the credit for socially disadvantaged farmers would give emerging farmers an added leg up and help them get established in their operations. And finally, giving the department the funding they need to put together an online application will make it much easier to access the credit. That's doing the handwritten application takes a little more time. I like to be able to do things on the computer, so I know that would save me a little time on that. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support and how I've been able to utilize the program thus far, and I'm happy to stand for any questions anyone may have.
Thank you, Mr. Clover, and I thank you for sharing your story. Next up, we have Ms. Kohler. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amanda Kohler. I'm a policy organizer at the Land Stewardship Project. LSP is a grassroots, people-driven organization. Our mission is to foster an ethic of stewardship for farmland, promote sustainable agriculture, and develop healthy communities. One of the Land Stewardship Project's greatest priorities is to train beginning farmers, sustain established farmers, and grow the number of farmers on the land. LSP supports passage of this bill as amended. The Beginning Farmer Tax Credit, as many folks have already said, is one tool through which our state currently invests in supporting beginning farmers. LSP members originally crafted the bill that led to the establishment of this program back in, I think, 2006. We created this to invest in training and financial support for young and beginning farmers. Since then, we've advocated for changes to ensure that the support is prioritized for those beginning farmers who need it most. Black, brown, indigenous people, people without inheritable land or assets, women, and people with disabilities. Therefore, we strongly support the provision in this bill that increases the tax credit for sale of land or assets to socially disadvantaged farmers. Due to the impacts of centuries of structural racism and theft, loss of land from these communities, beginning farmers who are Black, brown, and indigenous, immigrants of color, or refugees face the greatest barriers to accessing land, capital, and assets. This bill is a step toward addressing these injustices, one of many steps that are needed. While I'm talking right now, we actually have another LSP member in the Ag Committee talking about the emerging farmer the bill that is also another one of these important steps. So while we support this, and we also support allowing for 5% of the funds to be used for administration and to develop an online application, this is a sensible investment as strengthening the accessibility and administration will increase the effectiveness of this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kohler. We do not have any other testifiers. Member questions for the testifiers or Chair Marquardt? I see Chair Davis.
Thank you, Representative Lissegard, Chair Lissegard. And I'm extremely disappointed in the last testifier. This is a good bill. Of course it's a good bill because I did it originally. So we know it's a good bill, but to have to bring up systemic racism and injustices on Chairman Marquardt's bill is simply, it's extremely unfortunate that we have to go down that road. Let's actually talk about the bill and what it does. According to what the first testifier was saying, he was right on. What we need to do is we need to help beginning farmers farm. We've all heard the average age of the farmer and so forth. And in the past, as Chair Marquardt knows, I had concerns about between family members, and Chair Marquardt has put in safeguards that take away my concern for those issues between family members. There, the way it was originally proposed some years ago that Land Stewardship proposed and wanted, it was very loose, and there could be shenanigans, tomfoolery, and skullduggery built into the way we were. Very satisfied with Chair Marquardt's guardrails around this, but let's talk about getting farmers to farm and get beginning farmers in, and let's cut out the racism and the social injustice in the past. This is the tax committee. This is a tax issue. Let's create good tax policy for Minnesotans, which is what Representative Markworth's bill does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Next up, we have Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Chair Markworth. A good bill. I know that, you know, I grew up on a dairy farm between Nearstrand and Faribault, as I see James smiles over there. It was a farm that my grandfather homesteaded back many years ago. But Chair Markworth, I see you have to be a Minnesota resident to qualify. How about a U.S. citizen? Do you need to be a U.S. citizen?
Chair Markworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. I'm looking through the Department of Agricultural here definition. It says a Minnesota resident. That's as far as it says. And I don't know if there's staff that could clarify that or not, but it's Minnesota resident who is...
Mr. Yes. Williams?
It doesn't say anything more than that, so I would assume...
And Mr. Chair, the reason why I asked that question, you know, that there are other countries that are trying to buy up land and so forth. I would hope that this bill would apply to a U.S. citizen and Minnesota resident.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, I mean, I'm not changing anything on residency, so that is the current law, and there's no changes on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, any follow-up?
No, I that was just my question. I wanted to make sure that that was part of the language, that you had to be a U.S. citizen.
Okay, thank you. Well, you can't talk about farming without talking to Representative McDonald. So I had to say it. I mean,
certainly.
It was like on a tee. So
yeah, I teed it up for you. You hit
you
it
did.
Very well. 300 yards, better than Chair Davids could probably hit it up. So question, yes. Although I did grow up in the city of Watertown, I spent a lot of time on Old McDonald's farm. And I'm certainly have no farming. Well, the question I have for the chairman or Representative Markworth, we had a very good friend of ours who grew up on the farm. He was, I think, at the age 21 or 23. And after this bill passed, I think 2 years ago, I shared it with the mother because this young lad from Delano wanted to purchase some land out in the country and farm. And he grew up the farm, hard worker. I mean, he would be the epitome of a great farmer. Wanted to raise some cattle and grow some hay and some alfalfa and such. Anyway, he couldn't get a bank loan. Now he had, you know, he didn't have bad credit. He just was a young man. I really thought this program would be able to help him. He went from bank to bank to bank, and I tried to do what I could to help him. But he is the young man, the kind of person that we want this bill to help, that actually wants to go into farming and do it well. But he just couldn't find a loan or, you know, just couldn't get it. So just wondering what your thoughts are and if you experienced this in your research or any help that you can give that I can share with him.
Chair Markworth.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. I mean, that's a great question. And I mean, we know it is difficult for young people to get into farming because there's a lot of capital costs just to be able even to get the land that might be available there. But I was kind of doing more research on this, I read an article where a young family trying to you know, get into farming, usually one of the spouses has to have another job to get health insurance. A lot of times there's just all sorts of upfront costs. It's very difficult. And that's why one part of this program is where the Rural Finance Authority will step in and help folks at least get through the management, the financial management, which could help them get loans and that type of thing. But I don't have much more to add to that than just generally it is difficult for young people, young farmers to get into the business.
Representative McDonald, any follow-up?
Thank you, Representative Listegard. Yes, if I like the way you say it, I have chickens behind us. See these chickens? Hopefully these boys someday will grow up and stay on the family farm as well, but that's not who I'm talking about. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Markworth, for the bill. I do support this. Maybe the testifier from the Rural authority, the rural, I forget her name, but she testified earlier. Perhaps she could reach out to me and help. We need to do what we can to help these young farmers. And it's not like he wanted to, gee, I just wanted to go into farming. No, he grew up in the farm, and he is exactly the kind of person that we want to pass on a family farm or become a new farmer. So those who are on board or those who can help me, message me off line, and we'll look forward to the old McDonald song sung by Chair Listigard.
Thank you so much, Representative McDonald. Next Thank up, you. We have Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Listigard. So I first want to thank Chair Marquardt for bringing this bill forward, creating a tax credit for farmers is a great idea and much needed in the era of the pandemic and all the other pandemics that has been happening in Minnesota and across the country. I want to also thank Ms. I hope I pronounced her name right, Ms. Kohler, who presented and talked on the bill and really raised up the inequities that we have saw historically for farmers of color, specifically from my vantage point, from Black farmers here in America, and that includes Minnesota. And I just wanted to share just a little bit information because it's really important, you know, when that we have knowledge and information and a history of who we are, because if we do not as legislators in the 21st century, we will repeat the ills of the past from former legislators who put laws and policies in place that created inequities back out in our communities across the state of Minnesota. And so for a little, give me a few moments just to do a little history moment here, because I just want to say that today there are just about 45,000 African-Americans farmers, but just in like 1920, there was nearly a million Black farmers. Nearly a million Black farmers. And I want to talk about a young man by the name of John Boyd Jr., who is the son of a slave who slept with the deed of his farm under his mattress because he worried constantly that his land would be taken from him. And so, you know, and I just share that, and I would just stop that with the history, because there was many Black farmers where their land was actually taken from them, or they would go to the bank and could not get a loan. Not only could they not get a loan, but nor could they be heard or respected for the land that they own. And so just, you know, my question was going to be, and I don't need to know the question, because if it's a tax credit, it is there for anyone to apply to utilize the tax credit that is in place. But we need to know that, you know, as we are moving bills through this body, no one is trying to be divisive, but we are trying to be more informed legislators. Because I want to remind legislators in this body that the inequities and the disparity and the racism and structural racism that we saw in the past was created by policy makers who created laws that was unjust, that was unfair. And we have obligations today, lawmakers, to make things, make sure that we do no further harm as we move forward. So I just want to thank you, Chair Listigard, for allowing me to speak. I do want to thank Representative Marquardt for bringing this bill forward. It's a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Moran, for your words and putting things into context. So next up, we have Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Liz Lagarde. And I really appreciate Chair Moran's comments that she just made. Having just been in front of this committee yesterday and being yelled at for lecturing people, I was a little bit surprised at a lecture that we just received about structural and systemic racism. And for people who live it every single day, to hear those with great deal of privilege lecture us on what a bill does and does not do. And I just wanted to say thank you to Ms. Kohler for bringing up the real true fact about the systemic and structural racism around owning land, earning wealth, and being able to pass that down to the future generations. I want us to remember that in addition to what Representative Moran talked about, that this land originally belonged to Native Americans. And that land was taken from them. And then when African Americans were given land, that land was taken from them. And our Southeast Asian farmers, they are the ones that are upholding all of the farmers markets, the majority of the farmers markets across this state. And those farmers don't get to own land. They have not had the privilege of building wealth and being able to invest that wealth so that they can own that. They rent those land, they work the land, they get just whatever profits and from their sales of the produce. And if should something happen, they don't get to, it's just like our small business owners in St. Paul. They don't own their buildings, they don't own that land. So if something happens to it, they have no wealth that they can generate or that they can sell or that they can be able to start themselves over again. They've lost it. And so these types of bills, what Chair Marquardt brought forward is really important. And I really appreciate the fact that this was brought forward. And I want to remember that if people don't like to be lectured in this committee, they probably shouldn't be lecturing back to other people as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Next, we have Representative Hertaz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt, on the right track here for certainly a declining population of farmers, and we're going to need people to be on the farm in the future. I had a constituent the last couple of years I was trying to help and work with, maybe even thought of helping him personally in terms of being able to acquire land and farm, but the red tape and the problems with the existing Minnesota Farm Program and the aid that was there was untenable, and he couldn't overcome those barriers, even though he wasn't a minority. So he just couldn't qualify. But he was able to go to Iowa, and Iowa has a more robust program, and he now is a happy farm owner and farming in Iowa. So maybe we should investigate what Iowa's program is and maybe see if we can't incorporate it and be more inclusive for all people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertaz. Representative Abaji.
Thank you so much, Chair Lissagard. I just want to say again, thank you, Chair Marquardt, for bringing this bill forward. You know, our role as legislators is to solve problems. And when we see a problem, we go in and fix it. And what we do know is that it's difficult for young farmers to get into farming, whether they've been in it as a family business or whether they want to come in it from a group that has been historically disenfranchised from farming. So I appreciate that this bill wants to make farming much more enticing to young people, but also much more open, particularly to Black farmers and other farmers of color. We know that they have been systemically shut out of farming, from being denied loans to even having their farms stolen. And in fact, one of the largest civil lawsuits is titled Pigford v. Glickman, so I encourage people to look that up, is one of the largest civil lawsuit settlements, and it is about funding Black farmers because they were explicitly disenfranchised and discriminated against by our United States government. So I think a bill like this is a step forward in starting to repair those harms and also making sure that all people who want to have closeness with the land have an ability to farm and have an ability to come into that industry while not having to be prohibited because of the cost to entry of capital investments that it takes to farm. So thank you again, Chair Marquardt, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Abaji, for those words. Our last is Chair Davids.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Lissagard. And after all those lectures, I just want to get back to what the bill actually does. Chair Marquardt, could you just briefly, we've gone way far afield here, and I've been lectured to quite a bit today here, but what, could you sum up exactly what this bill does?
Chair Marquardt.
So Representative Lissagard and Chair Davids, could I do that in closing comments rather than now?
Mr. Chairman.
To
Mr.
save
Chairman,
some time.
You're the chairman. You can do whatever you want.
Any further comments, Chair Davids?
I'm going to reserve the right to talk again because I see another hand of the lecture.
Okay. Seeing no more. Nope. Yes. Representative Herr.
Chair Lissagard, I would like to address this body and the constant condescension from Minority Chair. It is unacceptable that he can continually sit here and point fingers at people for lecturing, and yet he is constantly lecturing. That is unacceptable behavior from somebody who thinks that they know better than everybody else within this committee. Unacceptable.
Okay.
I'm not done speaking. I am not done speaking.
What is the issue before us? What bill is before us, Mr. Chair?
Okay, so let's hold on here, please, everyone. Chair Lissagard is trying to manage through some very passionate viewpoints and different styles of leadership. While I appreciate that, I'm going off of Chair Marquardt's demeanor and decor in this body and in this committee, and that is exactly where we're going to stay. If individuals want to have a sidebar conversation, you do that. But it's not going to be in this committee. Stick to the subject matter. Thank you. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lissagard. And that's all I'm asking for, is people to stop making commentaries on other people's behavior and accusing them of intentions.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Representative. We are going to closing comments.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate that. Thank you.
We're going to closing comments. Representative Marquardt, to your bill. Closing comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This bill is, I want to allow everyone, no matter who you are, to have a chance to get into farming. And that's what this bill does. That's the intent of the original law. And I think this expands it. And looks at ways to get more people involved in this very important industry and keep farming alive and strong in Minnesota. So, members, I renew my motion on House File to lay over House File 1456 as amended for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill.
I'm so shook up, I forgot to hit the mute button. Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Chair Marquardt renews his motion that House File 1456, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill we have is 2114 from Chair Marquardt. Chair Marquardt, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 2114 be laid over for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill.
Chair Marquardt moves that House File 2114 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have the bill before us. Please present your bill, Chair Marquardt.
So thank you very much. Members, House File 2114 is a bill about bringing corporate profits that are earned in Minnesota and should be apportioned in Minnesota, but are shifted to other multinational subsidiaries and bring those tax dollars back to Minnesota. But maybe even more important, it's a bill about competitive fairness for small businesses, because as I kind of describe what is occurring here with profit shifting, is it puts our small businesses, our small Main Street businesses, at a huge disadvantage because they're not able to shift profits that are earned in Minnesota out to their subsidiaries or their controlled foreign corporations. And in many cases, these small businesses are competing directly with these multinational corporations. So for members who have been here last year and that, I apologize. But what I do really want to do is go over kind of what is the history and the background of profit shifting and what has been kind of the efforts by the federal government and others to address it. And I know some of you have heard this already. Some of you are aware of this bill, but I know there's a lot in the public that are watching and others that want. So, what is profit shifting? And that is what this bill really addresses. And that is when a domestic U.S. corporation here in the U.S. Shifts profits that are earned in the United States, but they use various methods to shift those profits to low-tax nations. Mm-hmm. And they need to do this through controlled foreign corporations. They have to have subsidiaries in other nations to set this up. And so what this ends up doing is eroding and lessening the United States corporate tax base and ultimately Minnesota's corporate tax base. And so how big of a problem is it? Back when the federal government was looking at the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that profit shifting probably is about $350 billion of income a year. $300 billion a year. And they thought with some of the provisions put in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that this might reduce it some to maybe roughly about $235 billion of profit shifting a year. A recent kind of paper on research on that said it really, the federal bill in 2017 hasn't really reduced the amount of profit shifting, but the paper did say in the long run it probably would reduce it 12 to 16%. So we're still in the $235 to $250 billion range of profit shifting. And how do we know that these dollars are being shifted? So in 2014, multinational corporations had to report their profits and where from. And in 2014, U.S. Corporations said they had $96 billion worth of profits in one country, in Bermuda. And yet the entire GDP, gross domestic product, in Bermuda is $6 billion. $96 billion of profits, only $6 billion total country GDP. And in the Cayman Islands, the U.S. corporations reported $40 billion of profits, and yet there's only $3 billion of total in the whole country of gross domestic product. So we know that those are totally profits earned through profit shifting. It's not because of any economic activity that's occurred in those countries. And a lot of times we refer to those countries as tax havens. So how is the profit shifting occurring? So probably there's several ways, but the one that's probably the most prevalent is when a domestic corporation here in the United States will transfer what's called intellectual or intangible property. And those could be trademarks, drug formulas, patents, copyrights, naming rights, internet domain names, those things that are tough to value and so forth. And what they'll do is they'll transfer those to one of their controlled foreign corporations in a low-tax nation. And then what they will do is they will either lease them back or pay royalty fees or buy back those rights. And so what that does is it increases the domestic corporation's expenses, which increases their deductions, which ultimately leads to lower income. So the income was earned, but by transferring out this intangible or intellectual property, they're able to, and then buying it back or leasing it back or whatever they do through royalty fees and such, they're able to increase their expenses, which lowers their income. Is this legal? Absolutely, it's legal. But is it right? And does it create huge competitive disadvantage? It creates huge competitive disadvantages. And so the federal government has dealt with this issue for over 40 years. In fact, in the early 1980s, there were 12 states that were using what was called worldwide combined reporting. And that is actually Representative Howard's bill. And they were doing this. And there's 1983 Supreme Court case that backed up the constitutionality of this approach. But some of the foreign countries and the corporations, they pressured Congress, and Congress went to these states and they said in the early 1980s, they said, you know, if you kind of do away with your worldwide reporting plans, we're going to do all we can to eliminate this base erosion and we're going to end this profit shifting. Well, 35 years went by and the problem only got worse. And so finally in 2017, when President Trump and the Republican Congress were looking at doing major tax reform, they understood that this was a huge problem, especially since the federal government in that act went to a territorial system on federal taxation, which means now you only get taxed in your foreign nation. And they thought, well, boy, with this, we better do some things. And so they came up with a tool. President Trump and Congress came up with something called Global Intangible Low Tax Income, otherwise known as GILTI. And I'm sure they had someone working overtime to come up with that acronym in Congress. But anyway, that's what it is. And there's a formula. And it's basically, if there is a kind of what's called a supernormal income in relationship to the property assets you have in any nation, it's over 10%. They basically say, you know what, that's got to be profits earned from, you know, the transfer of intellectual property, and it's too much for the property you have there. It raises this red flag that, in fact, this is money that, even though it was earned here in the U.S., is being shifted out, and the profits being shifted out to another nation. They put this in place. And so that's kind of the background of why we got to GILTI. So the big question now is House File 2114. What we do with House File 2114 is we use the federal government's definition of GILTI. And if a controlled foreign corporation triggers GILTI, we consider that corporate controlled foreign corporation a domestic corporation. We bring it into the domestic corporation, we pair the income, and then we apportion that as we do the percent of all sales that were done in Minnesota, as we do currently, and then we take that and times it by the corporate rate. So basically, we are bringing that income in, considering it a domestic corporation. We apply the very same rules, the very same standards of that controlled foreign corporation as we do to a domestic corporation, and with all the benefits. So there's one other provision in this bill. If a company says, you know what, that one foreign corporation isn't representative of all of our subsidiaries around the world, they can elect, if they want, to go to worldwide combined reporting. And they have to elect that for 10 years. So whatever one would benefit them the most, they can do that. So what is the revenue estimate for the bill? It's $435 million for 2022-23 and $381 million for 2024-25. And so while this raises a lot of revenue, it's because it's a big problem. It's a big problem. But this bill isn't about revenue. It's about returning those dollars back to Minnesota that were rightfully earned there. And it's about increasing competition or leveling the playing field for these small businesses to compete with these multinational corporations. And yet they're seeing increased taxes because these dollars aren't coming in to the state to be used for other services and so forth. We've got to do something. This is an area of our tax policy that is broken, and we cannot allow corporations to just kind of arbitrarily set the amount of income that's going to be apportioned to Minnesota, the United States. And we also can't rely on the federal government to do any more as far as enforcement. And so the federal government has given us this tool on GILTI, and that's what we're going to use. So members, thank you very much for your patience and kind of going through the history and so forth. But that is the bill, and I'll open for questions.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So we have testifiers. We have a half an hour, and we have another bill. I'm going to set the parameter right now. Each testifier has 3 minutes. I will have a stopwatch that I will hit, and with their 20 seconds left, I will let you know. I'll say 20. So you can wind down, and I'd be greatly appreciated. All questions will be held until the end. And our first testifier is Ms. Foley. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for having me. And I would just like to take this moment to acknowledge Representative Herr and Representative Morin. Thank you for calling out racism and misogyny. I really appreciate it, and I see you. I am a member of Main Street Alliance of Minnesota. I own Phoenix Grove Systems located in Anoka. We are a bookkeeping firm that works with small businesses. I have been doing this work since 2011. I've worked with at least 30 businesses during this time, and I focus our business is intentionally inclusive, and we focus on working with business owners from underrepresented and marginalized communities. As a small business owner, I can say that this measure would not negatively impact our small businesses. None of my revenue is sheltered abroad. None of my clients or contacts shelter their income in tax havens. A value of small businesses is that we generate income for local economies. We employ locally. We partner with other local businesses. Our customers are often local. Instead of harming small businesses, as might be claimed, this measure could help small businesses. This measure would tax big business. This would create a more level playing field for small businesses. Minnesota needs additional ongoing revenue to fund and create programs that support small businesses. This would give us the additional permanent revenue we need to fund access to healthcare, childcare, and funding capital for small businesses. Entrepreneurs take big risks when we start our businesses. There are very few, if any, safety nets. The pandemic highlighted this. A lot of us don't have health insurance. I don't have health insurance, and I know quite a few fellow entrepreneurs that don't either. MinCare and MinSure are inadequate for our needs. My premiums on MinSure were raised from $45 a month in 2018 to $200 a month in 2019. That's more than a 400% increase and was for worse coverage. To be clear, my income did not increase in a comparable amount. In fact, my income was down in 2019. It just wasn't affordable. A lot of small business owners, their families, and their employees would be more financially secure if the state made investments that put affordable, high-quality health insurance within reach, like Representative Schultz's bill to allow individuals and small businesses to opt into medical care. This would give more opportunities for current and new entrepreneurs, particularly those from underrepresented and marginalized communities. Please support HF 2114. Thank you.
Ms. Foley, that was incredible and efficient. I want to thank you for that. I just been notified by powers that be that we can push House File 2228, the Howard bill, to this evening if we don't make it. So next up, Ms. Dice, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Darwin Dice. I live in the country just outside of Ghent, Minnesota, where I raise chickens and host a community garden. I'm speaking in favor of House File 2114, partly because one of the big hurdles to passing legislation that helps people is we don't have enough in the budget. And those stalemates impact people who are really trying to get on their feet. I know personally of situations in my rural community where low-income folks who need programs like SNAP get cut off because they save precious dollars to buy a car, a pretty important thing in rural Minnesota. We need a car to get to the grocery store, obtain emergency medical services, get kids to after-school activities, etc. Also, I have friends who ration medicine and healthcare visits because they don't make the cut for Minnesota Care. Yes, such programs require the state to invest dollars, but the hardworking farmers, community members, and small businesses around me don't benefit when tax loopholes allow extremely well-off corporate entities to hide their money. Allowing the corporate world to hide exorbitant profits in hidden tax shelters enables taxable income to be withheld from supporting essential things like infrastructure, affordable housing, schools, developing broadband so desperately needed here in rural Minnesota. We've got a high school student living with us who at times struggled with class participation, not because of lack of interest, but because of lack of internet speed. How many small business startups have we lost because of lack of broadband service? People in rural Minnesota spend their money to survive, which means it circulates in the economy instead of sitting in a hidden offshore account. I support closing loopholes, be it through HF 2114 or any other tax bill that closes loopholes, leaving more dollars in our community. I'm proud to live in this state, especially when we do not see our interests or struggles as separate from one another and take on the challenge to find greater balance and equity. House File 2114 works to do just that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dice. Very well done yourself, time-wise. Next, we have Ms. Larson. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. My comments are directed at both House File 2114 and 2228 to save on time. While the bills aren't identical, they both deal with the concept of worldwide reporting, and we have some concerns with Minnesota moving to that tax system. This would be a significant change in corporate tax policy. It would make Minnesota an extreme outlier and would have really negative impacts on a lot of Minnesota's headquartered companies. No other state has worldwide reporting, and while technically not mandatory, House File 2114 essentially is that because of the way that the language is structured. We have concerns and questions about how the Department of Revenue would actually administer this new policy. House File 2114 gives the department broad authority to determine the unitary standard, which is unprecedented. Moving to a system of worldwide reporting would result in an extreme complexity of filing, added costs for both taxpayers and the department, probably very difficult for the department to audit worldwide income. Foreign subsidiaries don't have the same reporting requirements. And so it just adds a lot of complexity. But more important than that is that these proposals would make Minnesota less competitive and essentially penalize a lot of Minnesota headquartered businesses. You know, like non-U.S. companies, these Minnesota companies are competing around the world for business opportunities, for customers, for sales. And wherever those Minnesota companies operate, they are paying local taxes, whether it be income taxes, excise taxes, et cetera. But non-U.S. companies are not required to pay tax on income earned outside their own jurisdiction, as these bills would require Minnesota companies to pay. So this essentially puts Minnesota companies at a competitive disadvantage versus non-U.S. companies when they compete for business and investment. It essentially favors foreign-based companies. So it would be a big tax increase in a lot of Minnesota companies. We think that Minnesota should be working to encourage exports, encourage expansion into global markets, not penalize that expansion, not impede the ability of Minnesota's companies to compete. When these companies do expand, it creates good paying jobs here in Minnesota. So for these reasons, Mr. Chairman, we do oppose both of the bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Next we have Mr. Nicely. I hope I'm saying that right. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. You got my name exactly right. I'm just like the adverb.
You must be a nice guy.
It all depends on the issue, right? What perspective?
We'll find out here. You got 3 minutes to whether you're nice or not.
All right. Thank you very much. You know, I really echo a lot of Ms. Larson's concerns with House File 2114 and also House File 2028. And both do have integrated concepts of worldwide reporting. The Council on State Taxation, in case some of you are not aware of us, we are a nonprofit trade organization. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we represent most of the Fortune 500 members. And we are not about no taxation. We are about fair and equitable taxation for multi-jurisdictional businesses. And we want both small and large businesses to thrive. Our goal here is not to hinder small businesses whatsoever, to make sure all businesses can thrive. One thing I do want to note and make sure everyone realizes this is Minnesota's corporate income tax for the most recent figures that we have looking at fiscal years 2018 compared to 2019. The corporate income tax base actually increased by 21%. This is over the state average at the national level, which we saw from 2018 to 2019. It was a 17% increase. And a lot of this is related to the federal tax changes in 2017 that Chair Marquardt had discussed. Based on that, we don't see any urgency, a need for this massive change in how corporations are taxed in Minnesota. Specific concerns related to House File 2114 is how it treats controlled foreign corporations, in that it looks like it cherry picks those entities that are creating GILTI. However, if you have other CFCs that have losses, they would not be included in this approach. Now, there is an election to do worldwide combination, but just on its own, 2114, if you only had to include those creating GILTI, that it looks very much like it's one-sided and could be very inequitable. We're also very concerned with the revenue estimate. The revenue estimate appears to be based on other states that have tax haven provisions and looking at those having an 11% increase. And I know Montana is one state that has a tax haven provision. I don't think they've been able to show where they've had an 11% increase in their base. Addressing House File 2228, which would require combined reporting, we really look at this as taking a step backward. And I know, Chair McCord, you had mentioned how there was 12 other states that used to have this. They did all eliminate it. There was a lot of pressure, as you had indicated, in the 1970s and the 1980s from foreign corporations and also from multi-jurisdictional businesses to eliminate.
20 seconds.
And, I just want to say, that when we want Minnesota to thrive and we want Minnesota to remain competitive and not place businesses at a competitive disadvantage. So when it's appropriate time, be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nicely. Okay, member questions for any of the testifiers or Chair Marquardt? And it looks like we have Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question goes to Chair Marquardt. Could you explain again, too? I follow you. You're probably the only one that can explain this to me, so I appreciate that. But could you explain again that how Minnesota is a single apportionment state and how this works with that?
Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Chair Joaquin. So we are a single sales factor state, which means we only calculate the amount of sales a corporation does. So your payroll or your property doesn't make any difference at all. And so that's why if you look at, companies wouldn't relocate because it's based on sales. I mean, you can't take your customers and, with you, so to speak. And so the apportionment portion of it then is you figure out if you've got a company that does $1 million of sales throughout the United States, let's say, but does $100,000 in Minnesota, you would apportion it at 10%. That would be 10%. And so that way, of course, this corporation doesn't get taxed, many times over what they make. So it's apportioned based upon the percent of Minnesota sales versus their overall sales. And so when you bring in this corporate controlled foreign corporation, you would combine the income, but you also combine the sales. So the fact that none of the sales on this CFC were done in Minnesota, it would actually lower your apportionment of sales, but the amount of income could go up. So there's a multiplication there that has to take place.
Follow-up of Representative Joaquin?
No, thank you. That helps. It makes me realize that this really wouldn't force companies out of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandel.
Thank you, Chair Lisgard and Representative Marquardt. I have a couple of questions about it. I'm a little confused. First question is, would Minnesota be taxing proportionately the profits made on sales in other states? That's the first question. Second of all, how many of these Minnesota corporations are you talking about, and could you identify one or two or three? Thank you.
Chair Marquardt.
Yeah, so first question is, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandel. So it would not impact any of the income from inside the United States. It doesn't impact that one bit. And so, you know, a lot of these companies that might do the profit shifting through naming rights, and that could be drug companies, software companies. You know, I know Apple, you know, when we had deemed repatriation, I think they were the largest one for bringing back foreign profits, and not saying all those were shifted, but those would be the type of businesses or corporations.
Representative Sandel.
Thank you. Just quickly, Chair Lisgard, would this affect corporations selling goods, such as refrigerators or whatever, or would it also include corporations or partnerships making financial transactions, and where the product may be simply a financial investment?
Chair Marquardt.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Sandel, remember, this is only activated if the corporate or the controlled foreign corporation activates guilty, which is section 951 of the IRS code. So, you know, I'd have to dig into that more on that specifically. But if it triggers that, which means their income is more than 10% of basically tangible assets that they have in this country, it is just signifying, sending up the red flag that this is probably profit shifting. And so I guess I can't answer that specifically, but it would be contained in section 951 of the IRS code.
Any follow-up, Representative Sandel?
I'm sure you know, Representative Marquardt, that I support the bill and the conversations that we've had about things like this. But my concern is, of course, that I don't want to penalize Minnesota companies. I want to support Minnesota companies, because so many of our products, of course, are coming from Southeast Asia and China. And, you know, the hockey sticks I used to buy that were made in Warroad are now made in Vietnam. And I don't know why we chased the Persson brothers out of Warroad. So thank you very much. I appreciate the bill, Paul, and our Representative Marquardt. And thanks, Representative Lisgard.
Thank you, Representative Sandel. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Marquardt, I oppose this bill. And usually the narrative is when a middle-aged white guy Republican opposes a bill like this, we're trying to defend big business. That's the narrative, right? Well, I actually defend the consumer on this. Members and other people listening, corporations don't pay their taxes. Their customers do. That cost gets shifted down to the next level, because they're going to have profits that they're expected to have and what have you. And we can go into whether businesses move or not, but the bottom line is that when we find new ways to tax these businesses, the consumer ends up paying for that in the end. And I'd also like to add that Minnesota has enough tax revenue also, and we're talking about increasing tax revenue. Members, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. So I think we need to find ways to lessen the burden on the consumers here in Minnesota, not increase it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Marquardt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Miller, you bring up a great point. And the DOR, when they look at tax incidents on business, says it's regressive and a lot of it falls on consumers. But the Department of Revenue has also indicated that when it comes to national and foreign corporation, it's a different story. In fact, what they say here, and this was from a tax incident report on the 2018 tax bill, it says, quote, businesses selling in national or international markets are much less likely to shift the added cost to consumers by raising prices or to reduce the price in response. We know, and a lot of folks are recalibrating all of this because corporations in Minnesota received a 40% tax cut in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when the corporate rate went from 35 to 21. And yet we didn't see a lowering of prices. And what we saw actually, according to the Federal Reserve, is that stock buybacks from the fourth quarter of 2017 to the first quarter of 2018 went from $23 billion to $55 billion. So a lot of it was put back into the company. And so I share your concerns with regressivity and so forth, but when it comes to something like this, where you're talking about international corporate dollars, scholars and even the Department of Revenue says that might be a little different. And the last thing is I want to emphasize is this, while it raises a large proportion of revenue, this isn't about revenue. This is really, you have your small businesses that are competing with these global corporations, and they're selling the same product, but they're paying more in taxes than what they should be in comparison to this corporation that has the means to be able to shift it. Now, again, it's legal. We have great corporate partners in Minnesota, but, you know, I've heard kind of concerns about, you know, what it might be doing, but I haven't heard anyone say, how are we going to fix the problem? This is one way in which we fix the problem. And these are domestic dollars that should be taxed in Minnesota. They should be taxed in Minnesota, everything else being equal, but they're able to shift that out. And not only does that increase taxes for our businesses, but it decreases the amount of resources we have for our schools and healthcare and public safety and all the other areas. So this, I know it raises a lot of revenue, but it's trying to fix the problem because it's a big problem. These are dollars that should be apportioned to Minnesota.
Chair Lizegard.
Representative Miller.
Chair Lizegard and Chair Marquardt, we can somewhat resolve that issue by lessening the tax burden on our local businesses as well, which are entirely overtaxed in the state of Minnesota too.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Miller. Anyone else from any member want to ask a question, say a comment? Seeing none, closing comments, Chair Marquardt.
Well, members, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for this. This is something we need to address. The federal government has tried to address it, and they set it up so that this income passes down to the states. And they've given the states a tool to be able to address this problem, and I think this is one way, a fair way to do that. So members, thanks for the debate again. I would renew my motion to lay over House File 2114 for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Chair Marquardt renews his motion that House File 2114 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. I will now hand the virtual gavel, hammer, whatever you want to call it, back to Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Representative Lessegaard. So members, we're going to stop at this point. We're going to have three bills when we come back. We will hear Representative Howard's bill, Representative Hansen's bill, and Representative Lessegaard bill when we come back, and that will be at 6 p.m. So Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I'm continuing to receive, and I know we're recessed until this evening, emails and so forth from CPA firms around the state, and you can imagine what the issue is. It's PPP and the taxes on corporate taxes or not taxing on employment. Do you foresee us doing something? And again, my side of that, I will totally stand down if we could just get these through. The money's there. or do you see this going to the third week of May?
So thank you, Chair Davids. So I have control over our tax bill. And so, I mean, right now we're looking at having a tax bill posted and out the first week in April, right after the Easter Passover break. If leadership was to come to some sort of an agreement, and I think there would be more than just the Paycheck Protection Program, we're ready to go. I mean, we could put things together quickly, but that is a leadership question at this time. We will be doing conformity not only on the PPP, but also the unemployment insurance and then other areas that we've talked about here in the committee. But that's about all I can tell you at this point, Chair Davis.
And I really appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. And I do know that we have the Senate file 55-12 it passed over there. So I'm hoping, and I'll encourage leadership to at least bring that up. Let's get that out of the way, then we can work on the omnibus tax bill. But I'm not going to lecture you. We'll see you later.
Representative Hertaus.
I won't lecture either. Mr. Chair, regarding tonight and the additional bills, I had a question on House File 1733. That was a bill that imposes fees on transactions related to real estate transactions, recording documents at the county level. And I was just wondering why we didn't have that referred or why it wasn't heard in Property Tax Committee. That certainly seems like that should have been in our purview. You've been really straightforward in making those referrals to our committee, but this is one that clearly involves property and property taxes and recording of mortgages and mortgage deeds, and is just that situation that is local governments, counties would be imposing a fee. They would have the discretion. So I'm just wondering if you had a reason why that was not being referred to property tax and why you're hearing it in the tax committee instead.
Representative Hertaus, you are exactly right. It normally would have gone to property taxes, and it's mainly a timing issue. By the time it came out of one of the committees, they had to hear. And this, while it's not common, it does occur where we do hear things kind of late like this, where basically the property tax divisions kind of wrap things up. And so we take it to taxes. You're right. It, you know, in the best of all worlds, it would have gone to property tax division first. But just with timing, we couldn't do that.
Okay. Well, thanks for that explanation. And Mr. Chair, I had the unfortunate conversation this morning of hearing from one of our members who had a TIF bill that got introduced kind of late and was wanting to see if that could get included in the division report. And I indicated to him that it's maybe a little late to come to the party, and his community certainly came late to the party. But if that's the case with this bill, that we might hear it in taxes, maybe there's an opportunity to include one more little one paragraph, 5-year extension to the TIF in the tax bill.
And Representative Hertaus, I will tell you, we've been getting late notices from both sides of the aisle that we've had to turn down. But this is one bill that has gone through at least one committee, if not kind of two already, and it's got to get back to the Environment Committee, to the author. And so, I hear you, Representative Hertaus, and don't disagree with the thing, but it's just kind of a timing and so forth. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You and I seldomly disagree. Thank
you. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. See, how much time do you anticipate for tonight's meeting?
Representative McDonald, I would say at least an hour or more. I would say at least an hour probably between these. Probably, you know, 20-30 minutes for each bill, I would say, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Lestigard.
Representative Lestigard, do you have a question for Representative Lestigard?
Yes.
Representative Lestigard.
Representative Lestigard, sorry to do it this fashion, but could you give me a call regarding your bill tonight?
Very good. We are up at 2:30. We've got to close here. So members, we'll see you back at 6 o'clock. We're recessed until 6. Members? Thank you so much. We will get going again. Thank you for coming back after the recess. And the next bill up here is House File 2228. Representative Howard, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move this bill for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Howard moves House File 2228 be laid over for possible inclusion into the House Omnibus Tax Bill. Representative Howard, please begin.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I've been banished to the nursery slash home office for the night hearing, so but glad to be here to present this bill. And it is one that's similar in focus and goal to the previous bill, in which we see a tax system where corporations, large multinational corporations, use complicated tax practices to limit their tax liability, costing states and our country billions of dollars. And sometimes these companies are able to utilize these practices to eliminate all of their taxes. And I just want to highlight one of those examples. Right now we're on the Zoom platform. That's a business that most of us didn't have any idea existed a year ago. They had profits last year increased by 4,000%, yet they will pay zero federal taxes. And I don't know the specific, can't comment on the specific methods, but it just highlights that the ability of these large multinational corporations to avoid paying taxes. Meanwhile, wholly domestic Minnesota businesses, our Main Street businesses, they do not have those same tools to game the system to evade their tax liability. And this creates an unfair playing field in the marketplace. And of course, as all of us have shared in this committee in this session, we know that it's our smallest businesses that have been harmed the most during this pandemic. And so this bill aims to make our tax system more fair, leveling the playing field by utilizing a reporting method known as worldwide reporting. Currently, Minnesota is a water's edge state for tax collection purposes, meaning that we require businesses to report their income and profits from business conducting within the United States. But as was discussed earlier with Representative Marquardt's bill, we know that profits are being shifted out of this country. And I believe Representative Marquardt highlighted an example in Bermuda. Cayman Islands is another where they have profits of 1,000% of their entire island's GDP reported by corporations. And so what this worldwide reporting bill would do is simply require companies to report their worldwide profits from all of their subsidiaries. We would then use the single sales factor apportionment to account for their tax liability here in Minnesota. Worldwide reporting would have a positive effect in terms of leveling the playing field for small businesses. You know, they don't have the ability to shift their profits and earnings to the Cayman Islands. And based on research, it is a change that will be welcomed by our small businesses. A survey conducted of small businesses showed that 7 in 10 feel they are hurt when large businesses avoid taxes. 75% of those businesses said large corporations, quote, should not be able to choose to declare some or all of their income in a foreign country in order to lower their taxes. Members, during this pandemic, corporations and the ultra-rich have seen their profits soar, while thousands of Minnesotans and our smallest businesses have felt pain like never before. These disparate outcomes are not a product of chance. They are the product of policy choices that favor the rich and the powerful at the expense of many. And we have an opportunity to do something that is both right, fair, and just in passing this bill and building a state where all Minnesotans have the ability to thrive. And with that, I would open it up to questions.
Representative Howard, thank you so much. And let's go to testifiers first, if we can. Is Lynn Hoskins on the Zoom? Lynn Hoskins.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Howard.
I know that there was at least one testifier that was potentially going to have difficulty joining us in the evening and was going to submit testimony.
Okay. Okay, that could be Lynn Hoskins. Thank you. Davis Sensman.
Yep, right here.
Davis Sensman, welcome to the committee, and please. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and members of the committee. My name is Davis Sensman. I'm the founder of Davis Law Office, and I'm the co-chair of the advisory board of the Main Street Alliance of Minnesota. As a member of Main Street Alliance's advisory board and as a small business attorney with nearly 1,000 Minnesota small business clients, I'm here today to testify on their behalf to urge this committee to pass House File 2228. As you know, and as Representative Howard spoke to, Minnesota's small businesses and their hardworking owners have weathered the worst economic environment in any recent memory in this past year plus. Anything this committee, its counterparts in the Senate, and the governor's office can do to help those small businesses is welcome and desperately needed. And House File 2228 would do just that. It would be a small but important step towards helping our Minnesota small businesses, as it would raise revenue for the state from multinational corporations and level the playing field a bit for those who have not found ways to prosper through the pandemic. The small businesses that we represent through Main Street Alliance are the backbone of Minnesota. They provide nearly 50% of Minnesota jobs, and they're owned and operated by actual tax-paying Minnesota citizens, those that, according to the SBA, have a median income of less than $50,000, those that are paying taxes on all of their earnings and don't have the luxury of shifting portions of it to be claimed as income in a tax-haven country. These Minnesota business owners have spent the past year relying heavily on the social services that the great state of Minnesota has historically been able to provide and which are funded by our tax base. And after the year plus they've had, these Minnesota business owners, who often make very much less than $50,000 a year, are not worried about whether the income they've shifted offshore will be taxed, but they're worried about whether there will be enough money to fund MnSure or the Child Care Assistance Program if this current economic downturn continues. Even more, they'd like to see this legislature finally make investments that would make a huge difference for all of their families, their ability to attract and retain employees, and their bottom lines, like making healthcare accessible and affordable by establishing Minnesota Care as a public option for individuals, or expanding access to child care by raising CCAP reimbursement rates and building a plan to fully fund early childhood education so the families that work for their businesses don't have to pay more than 7% of their income for it. These are the issues Minnesota small business owners care about, and they broadly support paying for them and helping their fellow Minnesota citizen business owners by closing multinational corporate income tax loopholes via bills like House File 2228. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I think we'll go to the next testifier, and then if we have any questions for the testifiers, we will do it at that time. So Beth Cadoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Cadoon. Beth Cadoon and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are in strong opposition to these two bills, as they would greatly increase corporate tax burdens and harm Minnesota's competitiveness. I agree with the testimony provided earlier this afternoon by Ms. Larson and Mr. Nicely. I'll provide a few additional comments. The reality is Minnesota competes in a global marketplace and also competes with other states. So it is important for Minnesota to have a competitive business climate with other states and nations. This bill and the earlier Marquardt bill will result in large tax increases on many Minnesota-based headquartered companies and put them at a competitive disadvantage with their foreign competitors, not to mention the additional cost and complexities that would be created. As was well stated in the cost letters that you received and in previous testimony, these bills will make Minnesota an extreme tax outlier. As under House File 2228, no other state or country in the world uses the mandatory worldwide combined reporting method, and no other state utilizes the method in the earlier bill. This is trying to tax income earned outside of Minnesota and outside of the United States. House File 2228 would require mandatory worldwide combined reporting. And the other bill, although taking a different path, its practical impact of including the CFCs with GILTI and the domestic confined filing group is to compel Minnesota corporate taxpayers into something that closely also resembles mandatory worldwide combined reporting. This mandatory worldwide combined reporting had been tried in other states and rejected both for the international geopolitical reasons and due to the inequities and embedded complexities, including double taxation of foreign earnings. Most recently, this approach was considered again and rejected by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. We would urge Minnesota to reject this as well. In addition to raising taxes at this time, it's certainly hard to explain to our private sector employers and taxpayers that are already paying tax rates among the highest in the nation that they now need to pay even more, especially considering the fact that the state has a $1.6 billion surplus, $1.8 billion in budget reserves, $2.87 billion growth in spending that's already occurring under current law. Plus, there's an additional $7.95 billion in federal funds coming into the state from the American Rescue Plan, with $2.6 billion coming directly from the to the state. And add the fact that we're still in the midst of a pandemic and coming off the worst economic downturn in over 70 years. These bills would greatly increase the cost side of Minnesota's business climate that is already a serious concern. Although is not the only factor, the tax climate and cost issues are an important consideration in business decision-making and the flow of capital and investment. We urge you to oppose these two bills that will make Minnesota a tax outlier in the area of taxation of foreign income. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either one of the testifiers? And I don't see any further testifiers. Any questions from members? Very good. Questions from members for the author of the bill? Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howard, I think we're all worldwide combined reporting out today. We must have had enough guilty and worldwide reporting. Representative Howard.
Very good. That's just fine with me, Mr. Chair. In way of closing comments, I just did want to respond that there are, I think you might have mentioned this earlier today, Representative Marquardt, but there's about two dozen states that are taxing guilty, and there's a number of states looking at doing this as well. And it, whether it, other states are taking this approach or not, doesn't it seems to me the concept that we have when we have corporations shifting profits into the Bahamas and Cayman Islands, how in the world can we justify that when we see what, especially what our small businesses have been through this year? And so whether we have a budget surplus or budget deficit should not dictate what is plainly right and wrong. And that's what I see in this bill, an ability to create a fairer tax system for Minnesotans. And so with that, I'd encourage your support. And would renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Howard. Representative Howard renews his motion to lay over House File 2228 for possible inclusion into the House omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1975. Representative Les Legarde, would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Les Legarde moves to lay over House File 1975 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Would you like to move your A1 amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Les Legarde moves the A1 amendment. Any comments on this? Is that anything we need to know before we vote and put that onto the bill right now?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment clarifies one definition and makes a technical change to the section pertaining to how the credit will be allowed. It'll be discussed in the bill.
Very good. And members, any questions on that before we vote? If not, please unmute yourself temporarily as we vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Les Legarde to House File 1975 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. Before I read my brief remarks, this is really about opportunity for the state of Minnesota, an industry that is about to explode, and they're looking for a place to go. And Minnesota could build a foundation that is not only incredibly job creation in helping our businesses, but it can be sustainable. And that is what this is, maintaining the jobs we currently have and also creating new ones for the future in a time when we desperately need it in the state of Minnesota. So that's my little opening remarks. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am happy to bring House File 1975, which would create a film and TV credit for the state of Minnesota. This credit will be a powerful economic development tool for the state of Minnesota, and it has an impressive track record in other states and around the world. Multiple studies demonstrate that the benefit to local communities is amazing. In St. Louis County, the region where I'm from, we have seen the benefits from a tax program that was passed by the local county board. It should be noted that more than 30 other states have tax credits and or rebate programs for production made in their states. And while Minnesota has a rebate, it hasn't been consistently funded. An incentive program like a film credit is the only way to build this thriving industry and allow it to be sustainable. So many other states and countries have implemented film credits due to the success it brings. It is now a necessary condition for attracting large or any projects to our state. In conversations with HBO and other production and artist agencies in Los Angeles and Minnesota partners in this state, they all say they take a look first at what the state and what incentive it has to offer. This is truly a but-for proposal. Without a tax credit, they will not come. Minnesota is a perfect place to build this industry. We have workforce infrastructure in the relevant trades, which you're going to hear about later from our brothers and sisters in the industry and the trades that support it. We have the talent. We have the geographic diversity. We have the seasons. We have the interested parties, and we have the work ethic in this state. The missing ingredients is this incentive, and we have to move forward. The moment and the time is right. This is a bipartisan effort, and I want to thank both Democrats and Republicans who have reached out to me. Representative Abaji, Representative Howard, Joaquin, Representative Davids, McDonald's, all indicated their support for this. They see the moment and they want to seize it. I'd like to turn it over to Melody from the Minnesota Film and TV Commission to explain the bill and talk more about the industry as it relates to Minnesota with your permission, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Les Legarde. And I see we've got five testifiers, so I would ask each testifier to try to keep your testimony about 3 minutes. And Melody Bahan is first, and you would please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melody Bahan, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Film and TV. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 1975. Tax grams are investments states make to achieve specific goals, and this one is no different. Our goals are to bring new spending to Minnesota that will not otherwise come here, to create new high-paying jobs, to rebuild a workforce lost to other states since incentive programs began in the late 1990s, and to promote Minnesota as a great place to live, work, and visit. More than 30 states have production incentive programs as part of their economic development and job growth strategies. And the most successful of these programs are tax credit programs. This bill has been crafted to benefit Minnesota and the industry in our state. While some other states have more generous incentives than those in this bill, this program will allow Minnesota to compete for the billions of dollars that are spent on production each year in this country, and importantly, allow us to pursue a television or streaming series, a project that will spend multiple years in the state around which we can rebuild our industry and grow our workforce. The bill before you will create, a transferable tax credit of up to 25% on qualified in-state expenditures for TV and film production in Minnesota. The state puts out $0 on the credits until a production company spends the money here in the state first, paying all the applicable taxes on their spending. This bill also includes a number of guardrails. each project is required to submit an audit upon completion and prior to any credits being issued by the state. The bill also requires an economic impact report to the legislature after several years. The program is capped at $25 million per fiscal year and includes a sunset of 10 years. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bayon, for that. We'll move to the next, and we have Emily Larson. Mayor Larson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and please begin.
Good evening. Thank you, Chair Marquardt, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Emily Larson. I'm mayor of the city of Duluth, and I am here to speak in support of House File 1975. I'm grateful to spend just a few moments with you speaking to Representative Liz Lagarde's bill to create a state tax credit program for film and television. Here in Duluth and St. Louis County, we do have a tax incentive that's been put in place by the county board. We are grateful for that. It has definitely been utilized, and it is a very high visibility sign that our region is ready for film. We have 30 productions that are ready to go, that we have 30 projects that have an interest in coming here with a budget of $40 million total. A very conservative estimate of that $40 million is about 14 to $15 million of that would be spent locally. You've heard already that there are programs in other states with tax incentives. There's a tremendous amount of research and study that has been done in many of those states. In the state of Utah, for every $1 that was invested through incentive and utilized through incentive, there was a GDP increase to the state of $14. The revenue numbers work. The work ethic is there. You will hear about that shortly. Luring film and TV production is valuable to states and regions because production creates good jobs and injects money into the economy. We are already, as a city, investing our time and attention into workforce development strategies to build both above the line and below the line jobs that can sustain this economy. Production also brings visibility and a sense of prestige. Why that's important is because with that comes an interest to see where this is, where the action is, to see where the work is, to get tourists and to expand sales tax, not just for our city and our county and our region, but for the entire state. Like you've heard, 30 states, along with countries like Canada and Ireland, have very successful incentives that attract productions. And I want to be really clear, this is not just about if you build it, they will come. We have way more interest than we can support through the tax incentive. We have projects that are waiting. And if we had an expansion and a partnership with the state, they are coming and they're waiting. They are waiting on their production. Part of it is that other states have slowed down with COVID. Part of it is that there are projects that have had to slow down. They're ready to go. This region is ready. The city of Duluth, St. Louis County, is ready to be the home and the next great place of visual storytelling in the industry. I ask for your support of this bill, and I am ready to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mayor Larson. Nice to have you with us tonight. Next, we have Brian Simpson. Please introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Simpson. I'm a member of IATSC Local 490. As you heard, this industry is rapidly growing. There are 2.1 million jobs and $139 billion in wages each year in the United States. But what I want to talk about briefly is what this would be like in Minnesota. This bill is not about sustaining existing careers that we already have. This is about creating new careers. And if this bill were to pass, as it is written now, the existing labor pool in Minnesota would not be enough to satisfy the demand created. This would require training new employees, Minnesota residents, and these new careers will not require a college degree. It's oftentimes said that film and TV is nothing but temp jobs. Well, these are not temporary jobs. They are akin to the construction industry in that we are a project-based industry. This is also not a grant for the arts. This is more like modern-day manufacturing, and this is impossible to automate. Film and TV production, even the animated kind, can only be done by real people working real middle-class jobs. The jobs that will be created by this bill These will be union jobs. They will come with health benefits, retirement benefits. They will come with safety training, harassment prevention training, even equipment certification. And as I mentioned, this bill would require a significant increase in the Minnesota labor pool. In anticipation of that, we are already laying the groundwork for how that will happen in Minnesota. We'll be working with the Minnesota Film Office, MCTC, and DEED to create a certified jobs training program. Some of those classes will be taught by local 490 members so that we can build this industry back in Minnesota the right way. But we can't do this without this bill. Due to competition from other states and Canada, Minnesota's been exporting these jobs for at least 20 years now, but we can bring them back, and we need this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we have Ed Reynoso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please begin. Members. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent an excess of 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1975. Now, Teamsters represent virtually all of the drivers on a set. Anything on wheels is normally operated by a Teamster. We're normally the first ones on a set and the last ones off a set. And the work that our members perform provide great wages, as what was stated before by my brother, Brian, phenomenal benefits and a pension that allows them to live comfortably into retirement. But the problem is that we have here in Minnesota is that there's very little work for our members here in Minnesota. So they normally are chasing work in other states such as Pennsylvania, Virginia, Ohio, and Georgia. But we'd like to change that. We believe we can grow this industry here so that it provides new jobs for many Minnesotans. This industry supports in excess of 2.1 million jobs across the country. We believe that we can do many of those jobs here. And so we urge your support of House File 1975. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. The last person I have is Van Hayden. Very good. Welcome to the committee, and please state your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. Some of you may be familiar with my last name, one of your colleagues, Jeffrey Hayden. He's my second cousin. He didn't survive the last round, but he started on the House side and made it.
You bet. He was a former House member. Very good. Yes. Thanks for making that relationship there. So thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Well, I'm very happy to testify. I'm very versed.
Would you officially state your name then for the committee?
Yes, I am officially Van Hayden.
Very good.
a native of the Northland. It was wonderful to meet my mayor. I have not met her yet, Mayor Larson. Meeting her virtually here. I think she's met my sister, Vanny Hayden, we grew up in Duluth. We moved there when I was 5 years old. She was 7 years old. Our parents divorced. We ended up with our grandparents, growing up in Duluth. Always went through public schools, never spent a day in private school. Went to Lincoln Junior High and Lincoln Elementary and Denville and Central. So we covered the entire kind of range of the school system out there. And then I went to a little background. I came down to the U. I had decent enough grades to get into CLA and studied journalism and political science. That track took me into journalism, and I planned to be a Washington correspondent. That was my motivation, my goal. And I had several distinguished internships around the country at various newspapers. And I stumbled into this film business while working a summer internship in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Daily News. And I'd seen the movie, She's Gotta Have It, that Spike Lee directed. And it was like an epiphany. I said, wow, people are hired to make movies. I'd never really put that one and two together before. And that opened a whole possibility for me that never existed. When I finished school, I spent a year working at US Video over on Lake Street to be able to build my repertoire for knowledge of film. And And I sent a letter to Spike Lee one day saying, hey, I'd love to come out. I live in Minnesota. I'm born and raised here. And I'd love to come out and work on one of your next productions. Later that, the following week, I got a call saying, well, all of our entry-level jobs are filled. But, you know, if you're willing to come out here, put yourself up, we can't pay you. We'll feed you because they'll have a caterer and they provide food and stuff. And I said, I'd love to do it. And I did that. I went out there and that launched my entire career. That was in 1989. And ever since, and my dream is to bring film and television back to Minnesota. I live in Minneapolis. I live in the Minnehaha Park area. Right on Snelling, right off of the 46th Street train stop, the light rail stop. And, but I get on that train and I take it down to the airport. When I get offered jobs in Los Angeles, I just finished up the show Keenan for NBC. It's the new Warren Michaels spinoff from SNL, Keenan Thompson show. That show ended a week and a half ago. I got a call. Hey, are you available to come to Atlanta to do the reboot of the Wonder Years pilot? I said, sure. I came home for 2 days. I got back on the plane, and I was in Atlanta 3 hours later. And I guess this is the kind of nomadic lifestyle of the film crews that are from Minnesota. We have to keep going all these other places because we need this bill. We need a transferable tax credit because there's no, and I've done some producing myself. I brought two films to Minnesota. One we shot in Stillwater about 5 or 6 years ago.
And Mr. Hayden, would you finish in about 30 seconds, please?
Yes, I will. Yes, okay. I will.
Thank you.
As you know, my cousin, you know, we are long-winded.
Those senators, I understand.
No filibuster here, though. But the point is, we need this, and I am the typical film worker. I'm in a union. I have retirement benefits, and as Brian said so eloquently, you do not need a college education to make a real living wage. And I can't put myself behind this any stronger than I just did.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate that. So, members, any questions at this time for any of the testifiers? I don't see any. Members, any questions for the author of the bill or any comments on the bill? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to Representative Listergaard, I have co-authored this bill in the past and do support it. I personally have experienced what great economic activity it brings to a communities here in Minnesota, particularly A Simple Plan, which was filmed here in Delano, right outside my photo studio, in which I had a small Academy Award-winning six-second part in that movie. But more importantly, I saw what it did to our local town and the economy and the monies and the activities in the dead of winter in Minnesota. And just I know it's an important bill, and it's but for until we have this incentive, which I think is very good incentives for our state tax incentive, allowing companies and corporations to keep more of their money so they can invest it back into their businesses and make it profitable. And I think it's just a great idea, and I do support it. But a question for you, Representative Listergaard, because we do have a lot of great talent here, and I have a good friend, Milo Durbin. He's worked on many, many films, Fargo, and a list goes on. Many folks that are probably watching this know my friend Milo Durbin. He's in the film business. Anyway, we have great talent here. What assurances in your bill does it allow to make sure that when a production comes into Minnesota, and or even when local companies shoot commercials such as Target and other companies, Polaris, what assurances do we have in your bill that they'll use our good local Minnesota talents, from actors to extras to post-productions and grips and you name it?
Representative Lestergaard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was a wonderful question, Representative McDonald. I'm going to kick that right over to Melody, as this is her world, and she can best answer that question.
All right, very good. Ms. Bain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That is a great question. The incentive is geared to promote local hiring and local spending. Therefore, the wages that are covered, if you are flying in your crew and paying them for a Minnesota job, you're not going to get incentivized for those wages. You are only going to get incentive for the wages that are paid to Minnesota residents. That's how the programs work.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So is that language in the bill? Because the intent is great. Yes, we definitely want to use local talent, and sometimes that's just not feasible. So they do fly in and have other productions, other outside talent, and that's given. But what assurances do we have that we will use local talent? And I'll give you an example. Explore Minnesota, a number of years ago, did a commercial on Minnesota, but most everyone was hired in Wisconsin. The production, the films, talent, actors, Wisconsin, on Explore Minnesota. So I think we do need to make sure that there is in language in the law that when all possible, they use Minnesota talent to get that credit back.
So the question is that Representative Lessigard, is there language in the bill that says that? I think that's or Ms. Bann.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Melody to answer that.
Okay. Ms. Bann?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. If you look in the definitions, eligible production costs refers back to statute 116U.26, which is the statute that created the current rebate program, and eligible costs are defined as Minnesota wages in that. We would also, that is also something that would be covered in the administrative guidelines. But yes, it is in the original statute that created the program.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Then just again, I'll make it brief, Mr. Chair and Representative Lessigard. I have seen firsthand, I've actually been in about 5 or 6 film productions, television commercials and big films. So I do see what they bring to town and to our state. The activity, the economic activity, the excitement, it is good for our state, and it's a good business plan. But if they don't come, they're going somewhere else, we wouldn't get the money anyway. So it's a good program. I support it, and I thank you for bringing it to this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lessigard.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to speak up because we had a film made in Hopkins, too, quite a few years ago, Thin Ice with Greg Kinnear, and they had 40 people housed right in Hopkins in one of our warehouses for the production company. It was a smaller production. But I talked to business owners on Main Street and a lot of our lunch spots and how much money they made just in the local economy just for lunches and all the film crews that were here. It wasn't totally filmed in Hopkins, but the production studio was here, and they did have some stuff in Hopkins and all over the state. So I want to put a pitch in for seeing it happen in real time. And then I think I'm glad that Ms. Bann mentioned the original statute in reference, but also on line 2.3, it does say to the extent practicable that employees Minnesota residents. So there's a little belt and suspenders there as well, too. So thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Lessigard.
Thank you. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just had a question, and maybe this is for Rep. Lessigard or maybe for research, or I don't know, somebody else. But I'm just wondering about the transferability stuff and the sale of the tax credit. And if honestly, this is like a little confusing for me, I think, because I know I've had research explain this to me at least once. But I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about it and why that's necessary. Somebody, I don't know.
Miss Bann, you want to answer that, or we can go to staff too, but Ms. Bann?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gomez, I will try and answer that. Transferability is important. Like many other types of tax credits, there is a market for the buying and selling of these credits. So What happens is the credit is for a future Minnesota state tax liability that the credit holder has, so they can use that to offset their tax liability. If it's a company, if a company is awarded the tax credit that does not have a tax liability in Minnesota, then they are able to sell that tax credit to a Minnesota company that can take advantage of it and use the credit. There are other tax credits like historic tax credits and low-income housing tax credits that work in the same way with the transferability. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Williams, or whoever, would anyone care to also, or Mr. Clayman, is that the way you understand that to be?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, I wouldn't have much more to add to that. The transferability allows, you know, the person who qualifies for their credit to actually transfer that or to sell that to another taxpayer. And there could be a number of reasons why a taxpayer might want to do that. You know, for the historic structure credit, you know, there could be a nonprofit who's not taxable under Minnesota law, and they would want to sell that tax credit to somebody who could utilize it. And I think Ms. Behan was speaking about a similar issue where you might have a business that's not taxable in Minnesota, and they would want to sell that credit to a business that was.
Thank you very much. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. So a business that didn't have any Minnesota tax liability could then sell the credit and like get cash for it. Is that that's how this works?
Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, there's no real requirement that the person who the taxpayer who is, or the person who receives the credit has to not be able to take it in order to sell it. It just allows that to be transferred. And the language of the bill would seem like it only allows it once. So they could transfer it to one additional taxpayer, you know, if they wanted to, if it's in their interest to do so.
Representative Gomez.
I guess just a comment on that is that, you know, I think with my understanding was that with like, you know, low-income housing tax credits, for example, the reason that they're transferable like that is because, you know, it's really hard to put together financing for a housing project, an affordable housing project particularly, that qualifies for low-income housing tax credit. And I guess this is just me, but like to me, that's, you know, when we're giving, I mean, this seems like the transferability makes it a much more kind of, I don't know if it makes it much more expensive. I would imagine that it does, but it makes it a much more kind of valuable commodity, I think. And I don't know if there are other cases where we do this, but I guess for me, I'm sort of like the, you know, building affordable housing is like a compelling case for allowing that kind of flexibility that I think to me creates a little bit of like not as many guardrails around the program. So I guess that's just a comment, but I appreciate it. Thanks for the allowing me the latitude because I had trouble with the transferability stuff. Thanks.
You bet. Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Well, good evening again, Mr. Chair. And Representative McDonald forgot to mention one of the great classic movies filmed right here in Minnesota in my home city of Greenfield and Independence and his town of Delano, Grumpy Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
Was filmed in Lake Rebecca Park, all of the lake and fish house scenes. Representative Liz Lagarde, this production credit, as I understand, did expire some time ago. And could you talk about a little bit about reenactment of this, if it should happen, how the production industry waned in its absence and what this provides an opportunity, how much economic activity you think would come back? Do you have any information about that?
Representative Leslie Gart.
Mr. Chair and Representative Herzog, that's a great question. I'm going to address some of that in my closing comments, but I will go back to Ms. Bain from an industry perspective, since she lives this every day, that she probably could relay that question to you.
And I'm going to ask Mr. Clayman, have we ever had a credit for film credit, or has it always been the Snowbait grant rebate program? I don't know if we've ever had a credit.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not aware of any tax credit that the state has ever had for films, or maybe other testifiers that remember something in the past, but I don't remember anything in recent memory. There's been the fairly consistent appropriations to Minnesota Film and TV Board over the past number of years, but that's the only thing that I can think of off the top of my head right now.
Very good. So it looks like, thank you, Representative Hurtaugh's, Representative Lessegaard will address that in his closing statements. Is that okay on that part? Do you have other questions?
Yeah, just a little bit of a follow-up. So does anybody remember what that program was about and how much money we spent on that to get film production in terms of grants? Is somebody familiar with a dollar amount on that?
Yeah, it's anyone from staff. Otherwise, I can go to one of the testifiers.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Clayman, do you know?
Yeah, I believe in the last appropriation I saw to the Film and TV Board was $1 million in the last biennium. Again, there may be other testifiers that have a better handle on that, but.
Okay.
And Ms. Bain, have you got an idea of what that was with Snowbait?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. Yes, the production rebate program, also formerly known as Snowbait, has continued. It was established in the late 1990s and has been funded fairly inconsistently over the years anywhere from $5 million per fiscal year down to zero. And part of our desire to have a tax credit is to have some consistency. It's very difficult for producers, for companies to plan productions, which take a lot of work, a lot of time to prepare for, particularly for a series, an episodic program, if they don't know what program is going to exist. So the investment that was made in the rebate program has been fairly small, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I apologize. The return has been great, and we do have those numbers available, and I'd be happy to get those to you, Representative, tomorrow.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Hurtaugh.
Thank you. You know, and that was my memory even before I was in the legislature, that we were appropriating or having some type of a grant or aid or credit or something to basically lure or stimulate this type of activity and create a competitiveness with other markets in the state. So, you know, hearing numbers like 5 million, 1 million, 2 million, it sounds like since the 90s, for the last 20 years, we've had some of this, and then, of course, some of it has waned and perhaps less of it going. So is that fairly accurate, that that there's been kind of a dry well for a while here and that we haven't had this type of production in Minnesota? Is that correct?
Ms. Bayham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That is correct. We have not had what I would call a major production in, certainly not in the 4 years that I have been executive director of the organization, during which the per fiscal year appropriation for the rebate program has been $500,000. Generally, those funds are allocated within a month or two. Because the amount of money we're talking about for projects, you know, a television series will spend anywhere from $4 to $8 million per episode. And that's with a season of 10 episodes. So it's just our program has not kept pace with programs in other states.
Okay.
So Representative Hurtaugh.
Thank you. Closing comment, Mr. Chair. This has been good information, and it's pretty clear that the argument is being made that in order to have competitiveness with other states, we need this production credit and basically can stimulate this type of activity in our state. And so, Mr. Chair and Representative Lislegaard, I think you've just made the case what we've been saying for quite a long time, that lower taxes and competitiveness makes a very good reason to stimulate all Minnesota business, including those who produce other things beside movies. So I hope you would keep that in mind as you think this is a great idea, that those who are positioned here in a permanent way can remain competitive and grow their businesses, their companies, and their jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question maybe to fiscal staff, Mr. Thiemann, potentially. You know, we just heard a bill. The last bill we heard was talking about global income for businesses. And, you know, we're trying to attract particular types of businesses focused in on the film industry. And how would this interact? Let's say both of those bills were both passed. Would the film industry see a greater burden if they work internationally or just doing business throughout the United States as far as reporting that income while it's being created here in Minnesota? Would that kind of leave them open to those types of things, or how would that process work if these two bills were put together?
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski, you know, to some extent that's going to depend on, you know, whether a number of factors, you know, the first one being is the film production company or a studio, are they a corporation, and would they be subject to the corporate franchise tax versus the individual income tax if they're a pass-through entity? And then the other question would be, if so, does that business entity, does that production company, do they have nexus with the state of Minnesota such that the state could tax them? And they, you know, they may or may not, if there are, for instance, if there are business entities that would like to transfer the credit because they're not taxable in Minnesota, that could be a nexus issue. But if they did have nexus and they were a corporation, then that business's, you know, if the worldwide combined reporting bill was enacted, then that business would, or the members of the combined group that were taxable in Minnesota would apportion the worldwide income of the entire group. And so they could, in many cases, end up having the taxable income go up, and therefore the rate, therefore the amount of tax that they would pay would also go up at the same time. But there are a lot of, you know, different factors that would go into exactly what would happen in every situation. But that's probably the best I can do on the fly here, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think you did very well, Mr. Clayman, with a very complicated question. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Clayman, you did a great job. You know, I'm going to just kind of read into that answer a little bit, just with my next reply. But so if I were to read you correctly, if that production company has nexus in Minnesota and they are currently doing work outside of the state or internationally producing movies, they would actually have less incentive to perform more work here in the state because of that. If we were to bring those two together, so we'd actually put more incentive on out-of-state production companies because of if we combine those two, then simply production companies that would be located in the state.
Is that question, Representative Swedzinski, or comment?
I think that was more of a comment, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay.
Thank you for
very,
your time.
Very good. Very good. Thank you. I just wanted to be clear. Representative McDonald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my name was mentioned, and you know the history, of course, in this tradition of this committee. No, I did have a question regarding that, maybe for Mr. Clavin, but one of the reasons that I did mention Grumpy Old Men, Representative Hertos, is because I just started my photo studio here in Delano, and I try to sneak on the ice fishing, the Lake Rebecca, to take pictures, and some grumpy old men kicked me off. So that's why I didn't mention that. But anyway, see, similar to any professional sports player that plays here in our state, if any particular actor in a production, would they have to pay then the part of their income to state income tax? Is that what Representative Swazinski was talking about?
Mr. Klayman, like a baseball player, a football player, they play a certain amount of games or days in Minnesota. How does that work?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd have to look up the exact state statute that we have on this, but we do have some specific statutes in the state dealing with how, I believe, sports athletes, maybe entertainers, also are taxed. I'd have to take a look at that. But in general, putting aside any special laws we have on that, they would just be taxed as, you know, for instance, part year residents. And so they would just go through that process of apportioning their income based on their residency percentage.
Very good. Representative McDonald.
So just to follow up. So, for example, if there is a series filmed here, a 6 months to a 9 month series, that anyone on the set really would have to pay us a portion of their income tax to the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, if they have Minnesota source income, then they would be taxed on that income in Minnesota if they meet the filing threshold.
Representative McDonald.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, another non-incentive for them to film here, because you could go to a non-state that doesn't have any state income tax. So it's just food for thought on that as far as the income tax. But that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Les Legard, final comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. If you'd indulge me, I just would like to wrap this up into a story, a real life experience. And we heard about Mighty Ducks and we heard about Grumpy Old Men, great stories. But the state of Minnesota has lots of stories, trials and tribulations. And, I was 27 years old, married with two children. Worked at LTV until it closed in 2001, the very facility that my grandfather built. And at that, I was at a crossroads in my life. And I went back to school and at the local community college. And I had to take an elective, scared, fearful to go back to school. And I took a theater class, not to be an actor, but just as an extra. And the professor asked me to go. There was a screening. And for a rude and angry minor. And I was very skeptical to do it. But as a typical Ranger, extra credit, better grade, I'll go along and I'll do it. And the movie was a life-changing for this country. It was the first class action sexual harassment suit, Lois Jensen versus the Eblick Mines. A very sad time of history in this state and this country. But it was a story that needed to be told. And when I auditioned for that part, I got a call. And I took the part and I went and did it. And I built relationships. And I watched what that industry brought to a community in a region that lost so much. And, and the next thing you know, it was over. And they went to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And they went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, because that's where the incentive was. The story that changed the lives of so many people in this country that started in a certain location in Minnesota had to go to Santa Fe, New Mexico, because of a film credit. It is a but-for. So all the different stories that we have in this state, let's keep in mind, this last year has ripped this country, this world apart for so many different reasons. But right here in the state of Minnesota, we've had a situation, a travesty, that the whole world is watching. And at some point, they're going to tell that story. And we want that story to be told here. When we rebuild this city, when we rebuild the relationships between people, this story needs to be told in the state of Minnesota. And I guarantee you what, if we don't create an incentive and create jobs in an industry, they may come here and they may take a few shots. They may do a few scenes like they did for North Country, but they will leave.
and they will take that moment in history that will forever be remembered. They will take it somewhere else. So this is about creating jobs. It's about creating an industry, maintaining what we have, and bringing something for the future for the state of Minnesota. And I ask you seriously to support this, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Representative Leslie Garden. Testifiers, Representative Leslie Garden renews his motion to lay over House File 1975 as amended for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you all. Last bill we have is House File 1733, and we have Representative Hansen. I think I saw Representative Hansen. There he is. Very good.
I'm here.
So, members, we're going to be voting on this. So I will move House File 1733 to be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance and Policy. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee, and I know you have an amendment. Let's, if that's okay, can we move that amendment now? So I would
like to get the bill in the shape.
Very good. I'd like to move the A4 amendment. Any thoughts, Representative Hansen? Is this just to get it in the shape you'd like to see it?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any other comments from members? If not, I'm going to ask you to temporarily unmute yourself to call for the vote on the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm a little disappointed because I saw all the people leave after the last presentation, and I thought they were hanging around for my bill. But I'm pleased to be here in the Tax Committee, and the reason for this bill, 1733, which had been heard in my committee in another version and was also in Chair Lilly's committee, was trying to solve a problem that we have had with clean water funds. For the last 6 years, three different biennia, there has been an appropriation of over $20 million that has gone to soil and water conservation districts. And that large amount of money occurred in 2015, 2017, and 2019. And this year, the request was for $28 million that is in front of the legislature. What has happened over time, the clean water money is supposed to be special. It is supposed to be in addition. And so that short-term response back in 2015 has now lasted 6 years. In 2015 and in 2017, there was language that when there was a surplus, it would repay the clean water fund. In 2019, that did not happen. The other thing that has happened is that there have been some counties that have either reduced or stopped funding their soil and water conservation districts because they are now relying on clean water funds. Members, the clean water fund is in the constitutional amendment that will expire in 12 years. Relying on that fund to fund soil and water conservation districts is not appropriate and likely unconstitutional when it is not tied to water quality. What the original bill did was it provided for a local option so that there was some local commitment made tied to land so that when you purchase property in Minnesota, your county could provide that option of a fee that would help pay for those soil and water conservation activities in that county. That fee, a similar fee, has been in effect in the metro area for decades. I just closed on refinancing my mortgage, and I paid a $5 fee as part of that closing, a conservation fee. The amendment you just adopted is in response to the input that was received in the last two committees. There was concern raised by the counties about lack of uniformity. If one county provided it, maybe the other didn't. There was concern about how it would be applied, whether it would be equitable. So the amendment that you just adopted makes it mandatory, a $25 fee when you buy property and if you refinance your mortgage. That fee would be dedicated to soil and water conservation activities in that county. There are two counties that do not have soil and water conservation districts. The county has taken over those responsibilities in Hennepin and Ramsey County. So they would collect that fee. What this does is it ensures that there is a local match by the counties when we're applying for grants. It ensures that soil and water conservation district activities are tied to land. So when you buy property, you own that land and you're paying a fee that helps provide and protect the soil and water in your county. So I would ask for your support. I know there are a number of written testifiers, but I think they were responding to the prior bill. With the amendment, there are revisions.
Thank you very much, Representative Hansen. And I would draw your attention in on the website. There are a number of letters to House File 1733. We do have testifiers. And first up is Amanda Kohler. And again, we're asking for 3 minutes. And so welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I hope I'll be quicker than that. Thank you for the opportunity to come back again today. My name is Amanda Kohler. I'm a policy organizer at the Land Stewardship Project, leading our farmer-driven soil health campaign. We believe our state must publicly invest in programs that provide public benefits. When we care for the soil and invest in our farmers, we are cultivating resilient land, vibrant rural communities, clean water, productive crops, strong local economies, and a sustainable climate. We all benefit from the crucial work of our soil and water conservation districts. They're doing on the ground to support farmers, advance adoption of soil-healthy practices, and build a resilient and sustainable farming system. Regardless of zip code, SWCDs deserve to have sufficient budgets, staffing, and resources. Currently, SWCDs across the state have wildly unequal budgets. While some districts have as little as $10,000 per year, others have over $1 million. These inequalities are strikingly apparent on the landscape. And as I said, regardless of zip code, farmers deserve to have sufficient and equal support, technical assistance, and resources through their local SWCD. Right now, there's an incredibly uneven playing field for our farmers. This reminds me of our public education system in Minnesota. Because of the over-reliance on property tax levies, so many of our students are being left behind. Similarly, because of the over-reliance on inconsistent county appropriations, so many of our farmers and SWCDs are being left behind. While the state of Minnesota works toward finding a long-term, equitable, and reliable funding solution for our soil and water conservation districts, LSP believes this bill is an important step in the right direction. Together, we can pitch in to ensure that our SWCDs, farmers, and whole communities are as effective as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Paul Egger. There you are. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Egger, and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We have a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding our opposition to House File 1733, which would impose new $25 surcharges on both the mortgage registry and deed taxes. Minnesota Realtors does not believe the real estate transaction should be responsible for funding programs and activities that benefit all Minnesotans. We also oppose proposals that would increase the cost of housing, which House File 1733 does, by adding these new surcharges to the existing and regressive mortgage registry and deed taxes. For a little context regarding the fees proposed in House File 1733, consider that in fiscal year 2019, buyers and sellers paid over $256 million in mortgage registry and deed taxes. For each of those taxes, 97% goes to the general fund and 3% is retained by the counties. And when the market slows like it did during the Great Recession, mortgage registry and deed tax revenues drop. For example, from 2007 to 2008, mortgage registry and deed tax collections dropped by 24%, and then in 2009, they dropped another 19%. It is also important to understand that the number of transactions is not uniform across the state. For example, in 2020, our data shows there were 21,410 closed sales in Hennepin County, while in Kitson County, there were 17. And then there are the recording fees. And just a typical seller who's also buying their next home would pay the deed tax, pay the $46 recording fee for paying off their mortgage on the house they're selling, pay the mortgage registry tax on the house they're buying, pay the $46 recording fee for the mortgage registry, and then pay the $46 recording fee to record the deed. And then in certain counties, as Representative Hansen pointed out, there's an additional $5 conservation fee that's added. The new surcharges in House File 1733 would add to this list. I'd just also like to briefly address the comments made earlier that this revenue source is appropriate because it's tied to the land. Mr. Chair, those who pay the mortgage registry and deed taxes and other fees associated with those taxes and who would also pay these proposed fees already pay another tax tied to their land. It's called the property tax. We would just ask the legislature to refrain from increasing and adding fees on the purchase of a home. We respectfully urge you to reject the fees proposed in House File 1733. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Amber Boogie is next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Amber Boogie, and I serve as the Chief Deputy Recorder for Hennepin County, and I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association's Legislative Committee, for which I represent today. While the Minnesota County Recorders Association agrees that clean water is an important cause, an added surcharge to the recording fee is not the appropriate funding source for such an initiative. As has been stated, the current uniform recording fees were established in 2005 and supported by a wide range of coalition of interests, including Minnesota County Recorders, the Land Title Association, the Real Property Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and the Minnesota Realtors. This legislation is now a model for similar legislation throughout the country. These predictable fees are designed to ensure that each county recording office charges uniform fees for each document that allow our industry partners to transact business with us and support real estate commerce in our state. The current recording fee is standard across the state, and title companies and others who may rely on recording services know that there's one uniform recording fee for all counties and for most document types. This brings simplification and uniformity to the real estate industry, especially those who operate in multiple or even all counties. Predictable recording fees are desired as an industry standard for many reasons, with the ability to comply with consumer protection laws high on the list. Minnesota recorders prefer transparency in the fee that's charged for the recording service. A legitimate concern is that once one surcharge is added to the recording fee, the fee will become a vehicle for other surcharges to fund other programs and/or causes that are just as worthy as clean water. We are not just concerned about how adding surcharges to the recording fee affects recorders, but also how those surcharges affect our customers. The proposed legislation amendment continue to be concerning to recorders because although not permissive, it still only applies to certain documents. It would also apply to all transactions that are subject to mortgage registration and or state deed tax, regardless of the amount, thereby impacting residential transactions that are $3,000 and above in the same manner as a large commercial transaction. Also, not all constituents that pay this fee will see a direct benefit, as some properties are not located within a soil and water conservation district due to being in a township. If this provision becomes law, Minnesota will go from having one uniform transparent recording fee to having a different fee for mortgages and deeds. Some of the advantages to the current predictable fees are that when submitters can effectively predict recording fees, there is a reduction in errors. For recorders, this results in fewer rejections for shortages and overages, resulting in a cost savings to county employee time, postage, and office supplies.
Ms. Bourget, would you please finish up, please?
Yep, I've just got a few more lines. The primary benefits of predictable recording fees for consumers are avoiding delays in closing costs, confusing fee charges for the need to have disclosures to be re-executed, all leading to a more transparent experience for the consumer. I'd also like to mention that $10.50 of the recording fee goes to the state general fund and could be a solution for this funding. The Minnesota Recorders Association.
Please finish this up, please.
Thank you for your time today.
All right. Thank you. And sorry for mispronouncing your name.
No problem. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Brian Martinson.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Yes. My name is Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'd like to thank Representative Hansen for the changes that he's made to his proposal. And it addresses several of the concerns that have been raised by counties, and it also focuses the bill's purpose. AMC would like to take a closer look at the proposal to understand what this would mean for communities across the state and their conservation efforts. AMC believes that conservation and SWCD funding should be a state and local partnership. You will find in the AMC letter that I submitted to the committee, counties are investing local levy dollars in conservation and in the SWCDs. Those numbers have continued to grow every year, and larger increases over the last 6 years since state investment have increased those totals by more than $6 million to nearly $20 million. I would also be interested in seeing the data that supports the claim that counties have stopped supporting SWCDs. The data I've reviewed does not support that claim. Over the last 6 years, the state has supplemented the county allocations with clean water funds. That investment has enhanced the work of the districts across the state and allowed them to achieve greater outcomes than they would have achieved without the supplemental funding. State investments have lifted everyone up in a way that reliance on only local funding cannot. And I hope that this proposal is not intended to replace the state support with more local dollars. A quick review of the Department of Revenue estimates that suggest in 2020, a historically high year for transactions, that total revenue from this proposal would reach approximately $11 million statewide. However, the funds will be collected by the county and spent in that county. According to a breakdown of those same 2020 numbers, the data from the DOR, approximately 70% of the mortgage and fee revenues are generated in the 10 largest counties by population. So while this could be a positive result and outcomes for those communities, we will need to take a closer look at the impacts of this approach because it may not translate well to the amount of soil and water conservation needs for all counties. We look forward to further discussions about this potential reform to local conservation spending and hope that we can do that hand in hand with the continued discussion of a state investment. Thank you.
Mr. Martinson, thank you so much. So before we go to members' questions, Representative Hansen, any comment to testifiers and so forth, anything you'd like to say right now?
Yes, I need to counter a couple of statements that were made. So a soil and water conservation district in a county, for example, Chair Marquardt in Clay County, it includes the townships. So the whole county is the soil and water conservation district. There are two counties where there are two soil and water conservation districts because of the size of the counties. And then there's one county where it doesn't quite cover the entire county, but covers the vast majority of the county. So the statement that townships are not included in soil and water districts is incorrect. Secondly, existing law let me just find the citation here. So this bill is modeled after the existing law conservation fee, which if you give me just a moment, it's Minnesota Statute 40A.152, the county conservation fee, where the $5 fee is on the transaction. So we're modeling the very same language here. So the discussion about this hasn't been applied, or it's not applied evenly, or all of those things, you've had an existing fee in the metro area. And what the bill as amended does is provides $25 across the board. I appreciate this.
Representative Hansen, I'm going to cut you off right there. Thank you. I've been notified we have to be done at 7:30. I forgot there was a time limit tonight, again, but it is 7:30. So can you save some of that for your final comments, what you have left there, Representative Hansen, so we can go to the
members' questions? Yes, I'll be short.
Sorry. All right. Thank you. So Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question could be for to staff, or to anyone that would like to answer it. So it's my understanding that this $25 fee would be on any transaction over $3,000. So it would affect working families the same amount as it would be for a large business. So, I mean, could we consider this kind of a regressive tax or a regressive fee? So a larger percentage, and would that in turn, would that make housing or affordable housing more expensive in the state?
Ms. Hagler, the question is this fee apply equally across no matter what income level?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski, yes, it would be, the fee would apply to any transaction subject to the mortgage or deed tax, regardless of how expensive the property is or how much the mortgage is.
Very good. Representative Swedzinski.
So, Mr. Chair, just, you know, we've heard like progressive tax and we've heard regressive tax. So would this be considered progressive or would this be considered regressive?
You can, Representative Swedzinski, that's, I guess you would have to figure that out. It seems to apply equally to everyone. Representative Swedzinski?
I'm through, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Eggert, if he's still available.
Mr. Eggert.
Mr. Eggert, you represent the Realtors Association, which I am a member of and a licensed broker. In December of last year, median home prices in the Twin Cities reached $310,000 per home. That's half being above that amount and half being below. Mr. Eggert, could you share what the rates of taxation for state deed tax and mortgage registration tax are for members of the committee?
Mr. Eggert, answer that quickly if you can. We've got a couple more minutes, then we're going to move to a closing comments and a vote.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, real quickly, Representative Hertaus, the deed tax is 0.33% on the consideration, and the mortgage registry tax is 0.23% on the mortgage amount.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, members, you know, typically a home is financed, a new purchase would be 80% loan to value, would be the maximum amount. And just using the median home price, we're talking about $1,023 of state deed tax is collected on an average or median sale price in the Twin Cities, plus another $570 for mortgage registration tax. That totals $1,600 for today's current median home price. Now, this money is all deposited into the general fund. And I don't know what the number is. Maybe staff would know, but currently we're in excess of $250 million in collections
into the general fund. So the more appropriate way to do this is to appropriate the money from the general fund rather than adding on lopsided fees to what is already a heavily burdened industry with regard to making home affordability and home prices even more expensive. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hurtado. Representative Hansen, 1 minute on a closing or less, if you could, please. I see no one. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's important to remember why this bill is here. We have a limited constitutional fund that has specific purposes. Distributing $100,000 a year to each county for a soil and water district, each soil and water district, regardless of size, regardless of population, regardless of land, is the current status quo. That is not base funding. The legacy dollars are not base funding. They are two-year appropriations, and they will end in 12 years. This is a solution to a problem that people prefer to ignore. 6 years have gone by, number of task forces, number of meetings, number of
votes. Representative Hansen, we need to move to the vote.
I'd ask for your support. This solves a problem that is real.
Very good. I'd like to thank you very much, Representative Hansen. I'd like to renew my motion to re-refer House File 1733 as amended to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Ms. Griska, please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Aye.
Marquardt, aye. Lislegard.
Aye.
Lislegard, aye. David.
David Snow.
David Snow. Bajay.
Aye.
Bajay, aye. Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Detmer.
Me.
Detmer, no. Garofalo. Garofalo. Gomez.
Gomez, aye.
Gomez, aye. Her.
Her, aye.
Her, aye. Hurtado.
Hurtado, no.
Hurtado, no. Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. McDonald.
McDonald, no.
McDonald, no. Miller.
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Moran. Moran. Mortensen.
Mortensen, no.
Mortensen, no. Robbins.
No.
Robbins, no. Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Swazinski.
No.
Swazinski, no. Joachim.
Aye.
Joachim, aye. Garofalo. Moran.
There being, would you care to announce that, Ms. Griska?
Yep, there's 11 ayes, 8 nays.
There being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does prevail. House File 1733, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy. Members, thank you for your work today. And with that, we are adjourned.